Oh boy, our recording is in progress. Pressure's on. So I am here tonight to talk about the sixth precept. And I just am here. I'm just going to give some of my own personal reflections on the precept. I'd like to say some of it may work for you, some of it may not, but you learn something either way, right? I've learned just as much by hearing somebody speak and saying, "Oh, wow, that was really profound and cool and deep," just as much as I've learned from listening to people and then going, "Well, that was complete bullshit." So you still learn something about what works for you and what doesn't. So yeah, so that's what I'm going to do. That's my little disclaimer, little caveat on what I'm about to say. The precept of not dwelling on past mistakes. Do not dwell on past mistakes. Create wisdom from ignorance. In the realm of the flawless Dharma, not expounding upon error is the precept of not dwelling on past mistakes. In the Buddha Dharma, there is one path, one Dharma, one realization, one practice. Do not engage in fault finding. Do not condone haphazard talk. That's from the Kyo Jukaimon, which we recited earlier tonight and is our primary text for precept study. I first want to say thank you to the wonderful talks, everybody that's come before me, the first five precepts, for setting the tone for this year's precept study and for Jukai. It's very, very much appreciated. One thing that you're probably going to notice about, if you haven't already, about this particular precept is that this is the first, and it's not the last necessarily, precept that you can do, I don't like the word break. I like stray from the precept a little better than break the precept. You can stray from the precept just as easily on the cushion as you can off. And Domyo actually hinted at this in the Zen Studies podcast, episode 274, something to this very, very same effect that, I can't really, if you're talking about in kind of relative terms, you can't really kill or steal or lie or commit sexual infidelity or, get intoxicated while you're sitting on the cushion. Maybe at a really subtle level, you can do those things. Like, oh, I'm killing time by pondering the plot line of that Netflix show while I'm supposed to be doing Zazen. I mean, okay, fine. But this is the one, like, even at the most relative level, you can, and we probably have strayed from that precept. I'll speak for myself. I've strayed from this precept more on the cushion than I ever do off, because I, in that outside world, so to speak, I'm engaging with others, and I'm distracted. I'm not focusing just on my own mind. But man, when I'm just sitting on that cushion and it's nothing but me and all of the craziness of my mind, oh man, this precept definitely gets straight from. So I'd like you to keep that top of mind as we go through the evening's discussion, because I think it's a really important point for us to recall, especially when we're doing Zazen, and then when we're taking that mind of stillness out into our regular life, so to speak. I don't want to do a whole lot of reading or reference to other teachings, but I would like to throw out a couple of the other interpretations of this precept from some other precept texts. In Mind of Clover, Robert Aitken has a really interesting point that he makes about this precept that I love. And I will quote him in this one, where he says, "This precept is the way of Jesus when he said, 'Judge not, lest ye be judged yourselves.' From Bodhidharma's point of view, this would mean when you judge, you place yourself in the dimension of good and bad. Or as Zen Master Wu Men wrote, if you think right and wrong, you are a person of right and wrong." And so I would also like you to hold that idea that we are facing this dichotomy where we're setting up self and other, we're setting up this difference between what's good and what's bad, and what's right and what's wrong, and what's up and what's down, and left and right, and whatnot. And that's necessary, of course, to a certain degree in our practical everyday lives. But how can we go beyond that? How can we find that place of oneness, that place of no separation. In her book, Opening to Oneness, Nancy Mujo Baker terms this precept non-talking about others' errors and faults. And that's an important element of this precept as well. That's hinted at in the Kyoju Kaimon, where it's not simply about the internal exercise of dwelling on past mistakes. There's also that external component where I'm, you know, coming this up to Eric and say, can you believe what that person, I can't believe what they said or did. I just, right. And we're commiserating and we're talking poorly about others. We're, there's judgment being passed on another person for how they have acted and what they've said or done. And then in her book, Waking Up to What You Do, Eshin Rosetto says, and I love that book, and I know we use that as the text for a year's precept study, because she takes all of the precepts and turns them on their end and phrases them in the positive, as opposed to the negative, don't do this thing. And so this one she terms, speaking of others with openness and possibility. Just love that. I have nothing to say about that. I'm going to let that one stand for itself. That's just beautiful. So a good kind of an intellectual exercise when we're dealing with things of this nature is to kind of tease apart the meanings of the words. What do we mean by dwell on past mistakes? What do we mean by dwell? What do we mean by past? What do we mean by mistake? And so I'd like to take that apart just a little bit. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it, but I think it's helpful to us as we dig into these precepts and we really try to look at them from every possible angle and try to figure out, how does this relate to my life? How does this relate to my practice? How do I engage the world, engage with myself, engage with others in relation to this precept? Dwelling. What does it mean to dwell? Well, this probably seems fairly obvious. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary says, to remain for a time, to live as a resident, to keep the attention directed upon. That last little bit is going to become a very important element of this precept as we go forward. I also took the word dwell and I plugged it into, you know, you go into Google and you do the whole search engine, right? And now, I don't know how long it's been, like the last year or 2 years, whatever, the generative AI or whatever, like Gemini, whatever they call it. And then gives you a little summary first, right? Before, which I find very helpful, is like that. Saves me the time of going through 25 different websites to try to find the answers. Like, it's all right there. Great. You know, to whatever degree it's accurate, I don't know. But Google's generative AI gave what I think is actually a better answer in relation to this precept than the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. To linger or remain fixated. To keep thinking or talking about something, especially something unpleasant. Mm-hmm. 1 point for Google. So there's this element to it of digging in, of staying entrenched, of trying to reify and solidify just one version of reality. Right? Taking one event and just, I'm going to fixate on this. I'm going to put it in this box and it's going to stay there. And this is the way it is. And this is the way it always will be. But interestingly enough, there's such a thing as good dwelling, right? I mean, there's just the normal everyday, I dwell in a house. That's a good thing. It's good I have a house. It protects my family and my cats, you know, my stuff. But in the sense of the Dharma, all throughout the Pali canon, the original Buddhist teachings, there's a term that in the Pali is bhikkhu viharati, which means the bhikkhu being a monk, and viharati meaning to dwell. It's a verb meaning to dwell. And when you convert that to a noun, and it changes to vihara, V-I-H-A-R-A, which is actually the name for where monks would live, right? There's actually places, I think there's even one up in Washington State, maybe called a vihara, right? And it's a place where a bunch of female monastics live. Not exclusively for female monastics, but it's just a general dwelling place. So that sounds like a good thing, right? That's a good, we should dwell in a place like that. We should be bhikkhu vihara, you know, in a bhikkhu vihara ourselves. And so there's this element here of it being about If dwelling itself is neither good nor bad, what is it about this precept then that we need to ponder? And it's about, where are we dwelling? What is our intention for dwelling in a specific place at a specific time? What are we trying to accomplish by dwelling here and not over there? Are we dwelling in the past, in the present, or in the future? Let's talk about past, since that word is actually in the precept itself, dwelling on past mistakes. Well, we all know what the past is, right? It's the time that came before this time. Right? When I just said the word time, that's now in the past, right? So time is gone, that no longer exists. And now when I said the word exists, that is also gone. Right? It's moment by moment, a new past is being created. So when we talk about dwelling in the past, right, the terms here being very closely related, if we're talking about dwelling in the past, what we mean then is we're fixating on, we're continuing to ruminate on, we're continuing to dwell in a place that is no longer the present. We're not fixated on this moment and this time with situation as it is right here, right now. We're fixated on something that has already passed. We can continue to replay that movie, right? Especially if the mistake that we're dwelling on, we'll talk about mistake in a second, especially if it was pretty bad, pretty egregious, very hurtful, harmful, devastating, traumatic. We really can find ourselves dwelling there a lot, right? And dwelling there in a really intense, focused way. I don't know about any of you, but I've certainly been there, laying awake at night, just replaying that movie. How could they do that? How could they say that? Why did they do that? Why did they say that? And look at the consequences. Was it worth it? And then the anger builds, you know, and then the frustration builds and the betrayal builds or whatever it is that's coming up by replaying that movie. There's a part of the brain, I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know the science behind this, but from my understanding, there's a part of the brain that doesn't know the difference between the original traumatic event itself and a memory, a replayed memory of the traumatic event. Like there's a part of the brain that responds exactly the same way to remembering something bad as it reacted to the original bad thing itself. So it's like we continue to injure ourselves by dwelling on this past event. The past event was bad enough, but now we just got to keep looping and looping and looping and looping and doing it to ourselves over and over and over again. And since we're talking in this context about dwelling on the past mistakes of somebody else, well, do you think they're dwelling on the past mistake? In a lot of cases, they probably aren't. They're off doing whatever, right? They're sitting on the couch watching Netflix while you're over there continuing to replay this terrible thing that they did. In the talk that I led two months ago, I very pointedly referred to this as the second arrow, right? Where the injurious event was bad enough, but now we've got to add more insult, more suffering on top of that original pain. But here's the interesting thing about remembering the past, the dwelling in the past. In his commentary on the Threefold Lotus Sutra, the Buddhist author, Brooke Zipperin, has a really, really interesting way of framing this. He uses the term recontextualization. That's a big word, lots of syllables. Mm-hmm. Too many syllables. I get to like the third syllable and I've checked out. I don't even know what he's talking about anymore. But he's taking Dogen's words from the fascicle Uji, being time. In being time, in the fascicle Uji, Dogen refers to what we call today flows into tomorrow. Today flows into yesterday. Yesterday flows into today. More or less, that's the translation. And so there's this idea that the three types of time flow into each other. It's not linear. It's not like there's the past and now it's gone and here's the present and now it's going to be gone soon and then it's going to be the future. And once they're gone, that's it. There's this idea that it all flows very seamlessly together. And which, of course, Dogen was very heavily influenced by the Lotus Sutra. So it's natural that that type of mind, that type of idea would be found also in the Lotus Sutra. So in his commentary on the Lotus Sutra, Brooke Zipperin calls this recontextualization, where we are remembering the past event. We're dwelling on this past event, but we're doing it from the context of the present. And by looking from the present back at a past event, we are automatically coloring it with bias that comes from where we're at right now. Whatever the consequences of that event were, now, 5 minutes, 5 months, 5 years later, we're looking back at it through the lens of knowing how it came out. Right. And so our memory of the original event gets changed by that. It's recontextualized. It's altered. The memory is altered. The memory of the event is altered in the framework of where we're at today. So we're not really remembering it as it actually happened. We're remembering it as we believe it happened based on the outcomes that it had. And I wonder sometimes, like, if somebody actually had a video camera that was recording the actual original event and then stuck it away for, 5 years. And I'm sitting here five years later going, man, that thing that she said or she did, and I just can't believe it. And there's like, oh, yeah, want to bet? Here's the movie replay that I probably would look at and say, well, that's not how I remember it happening. And so does that matter? Well, probably not. I mean, that's automatic, right? That's how our brains work. But it's important for us to keep that in mind as we find ourselves dwelling on past mistakes, to remember, like, am I really truly remembering this the way it happened? Or am I only remembering it through the lens of how I responded to that situation, my, what hurt I suffered, what biases I have, and that wasn't really the way that it happened. There's also a degree to which it only seems like that original event might have only been a mistake because it had a negative outcome. What if somebody performs an action that one person might think is a mistake, but then it actually had a positive outcome or a positive consequence? Right? That's probably happened. Like, oh, that's a horrible mistake you made. Oh, well, actually, no. Right? Think right off the top of my head, my ex-wife, right? Oh, there's a touchy subject, right? Let's all start talking about our exes. My ex-wife committed horrible mistakes, but damn it, she did. And now it had a positive, it didn't have a positive outcome at the time. I was traumatized and I dwelled on those past mistakes for a long time. My therapist heard all about it for a long time, right? But now I'm like, thank God she did that, because I'm way happier now. So is our colored view when we dwell on a past mistake really the accurate depiction of it? In the fascicle on instructions to the cook, the Tenzo, in the monastery, he instructs the Tenzo to serve everyone in the monastery the same, because though someone may have been mistaken in the past, they may very well be correct in the context of things now. And so right there, he's already hinting at, past mistakes, right? That's bad, shouldn't have done that, whatever. There's harm caused. We need to remember that. We need to hold you accountable for that. But you also deserve to be served the same as everyone else. Mistake.
Oh, mistake. What a loaded word.
The word mistake actually comes from an old Norse and Middle English word that literally meant to take an error. It used to be a verb. We refer to it as a noun now, right? And so that was a mistake. It was a thing that happened, but it used to be a verb to someone who you were mistaking. And literally, like the prefix mis in this context is the same as what we would say in misunderstood, misled, misdirected, right? You took an error, you mistook, right? And so what does it mean to take an error? Right? Well, we could say, well, you that was a mistake, what you said to me, right? So we're taking, maybe that person was taking some of our trusts. Right? Maybe they were taking some of our sense of well-being, some of our happiness. And so in that sense, there could be a connection to the precept against not stealing, right? Do not take in error, do not mistake. And so we get here, we can think about the judgment call. How do you view someone who is otherwise like a really, really very moral, very upstanding citizen, just a good person, they've never done anything wrong, and they make a mistake? Versus a person who you say, oh, that person's not, they're not a good person. They've made a whole ton of mistakes. Do we view the saint who makes a single mistake any different from the sinner who's made many mistakes? We probably do, right? We view them differently. We pass judgment. But do we dwell on our own mistakes? That's actually why I chose this precept to begin with, to be honest with you. I'd forgotten what the actual language of the precept was. And I said, oh, dwelling on past mistakes, I've done that. I've made so many mistakes and I've dwelt on them for a long time. And then I read the precept. I was like, oh, it's talking about mistakes of others. Shoot, okay, I got to rethink this. So as we, and this goes to what Robert Aitken was saying, are we judging others lest we be judged ourselves? Are we passing judgment on others, but maybe not passing judgment on ourselves? An interesting way to think about this word mistake, I think, is to remember that everything that we see as a mistake, every bad action, was done by something, someone who was at least mostly absolutely certain that they were right. And they went ahead and did a thing that we think was terrible. I'm going to hint at this a little later. So we're calling something a mistake as somewhat of a judgment call. It's a little bit retroactive, right? So we were talking, as I was saying earlier, about dwelling on a past mistake or that recontextualization. It's a mistake mostly in the context of what the consequences were. And then there's intention. So if I'm unloading the dishwasher and I take out a glass, and I'm going too quickly, right? And I drop the glass and it breaks. It was my wife's favorite glass. It came from her great aunt, whom she loved, and she just cherishes this glass. And it shouldn't have been in a dishwasher to begin with. It should have been hand washed, right? And I drop it and it breaks. Well, there was no intention to break the glass, right? As opposed to me taking the dishwasher alone and just dropping it, right? She's going to be dwelling on that mistake, right, for a while. Like, why would he do so? He knows that's my favorite glass. How could he? I can't believe it. Whereas if I dropped it by accident, she would be upset, but she's not going to blame me. That's not a mistake that she's going to necessarily dwell upon. So how much does the supposed or apparent intention of the person creating or the person committing, how much does that play into our judgment? So a little bit of a personal story about, you know, of course, I've got many stories about dwelling on past mistakes of others in particular, including my own. But since the language is talking primarily about others, I have a family member who, from a very young age, started doing unskillful things, stealing money and items from others. And eventually wound up stealing from me. I was already in graduate school at college, and this family member wanted to come to college. And And I said, "Oh, great! Let me help you out." And he goes, "You live with me. We'll share an apartment, and we'll make it work." And I'm busy with grad school, and so I would give money to him. So pay the power bill, pay the utilities, whatever. And a couple of months goes by, and all of a sudden the power gets shut off. I was like, "Why is the power get shut off? We just paid the bill." Call utility companies. "Well, you haven't paid us in 3 months." "What are you talking about? I haven't paid you in 3 months." And he was pocketing the money and spending it. It's supposed to be for our utilities. I came home from a Thanksgiving break, and there was a note on the door from the sheriff's office about a burglary. My apartment had been broken into. So I called the sheriff. He came over and he goes, "Yeah, I don't think anybody burglarized your house. I think it was your family member that you're living with. I think he staged it and took the stuff that was supposedly stolen and pawned it off." So I'm like, "I'm done with this," and I move out, and I move in with another guy, and he just left him on his own. Get a call from my friend. Like, "Well, I had given him the key to my apartment over the break because he was going to work on some stuff for the school, you know. And I just got home and my credit card called me and said, why are there thousands of dollars in charges that this credit card hasn't been used in years, and suddenly there's $5,000 worth of charges in the last couple of weeks. What's going on?" And he investigated it. He just said, "Your family member had the key to my apartment, took a credit card out of one of my, you know, where I had it stored, and just started charging stuff up all around town. Credit card fraud." So call the cops. So he wound up in jail. The first of a handful of prison sentences. Many embezzled from the university. Then he does a couple other things. So in the process of all of this, he's lying to me. He's lying to the other family members. He's stealing from, he stole from me. He kind of damaged my credit for a little bit because, then the utility companies were kind of on my case. And so a lot of very serious harm done to me, to my family. And just kind of unforgivable stuff. And even when the harm wasn't being to me, he's harming, his wife and his kids and all that type of thing. And here's another crime, and he got sentenced to 3 years in prison, and now he's in prison. And okay, now he's out of prison. Maybe he'll get his life back together 5 years later. Oh, he committed another crime. Now he's back in prison again. So, and the worst part of it for me is that when he's out of prison, which he currently is, he has been for about a year, he kind of acts like nothing ever happened. There's no remorse, never an apology, never any ownership for all of these horrible things. Just like, "Hey, what are you doing, man?" So can I look at him with, as Eshin Rosetta says, can I look at him with eyes of openness and possibility? Boy, that's a tough one, Because can any of us who have had some sort of our own traumatic interactions with family members or friends or whoever, mistakes have been made, can we do the same despite the suffering that has come from those actions? So why do we dwell? I mean, obviously, it's bad enough that we get hurt, or it's bad enough that harm is caused by mistakes that others, by the mistakes of others. But why do we dwell on them? I think sometimes in my own dwelling on others' mistakes, I think maybe I'm like trying to retroactively fix it. Like there's some part of my subconscious that thinks, if you just think about this enough, you'll change it. And it won't have happened. But I think it's more than that. I think we're trying to understand. We're trying to figure out how could a normally reasonable, rational person, who I thought was a reasonable, rational, loving person, how could they do that? How could they say that? And we're seeking that deeper understanding. If I can just get to the heart of why they did it, then it won't matter. as much. Maybe, although we know it does. We just have to know why. How could you? We like things to be simple. We want good people to do good things and bad people to do bad things. But we never want the good people to do the bad things, right? And so falling on past mistakes, I think, happens a lot when people, that, like this family member, I trusted. I helped. I'd known from childhood. A close family member shared a lot of great times in common, and then he did this. How could he, right? Ultimately, though, as we get deeper into the layers of the precept, we get closer to the ultimate truth of the precept. What we're really doing is setting up a discrimination of self and other. I am different from them. They caused the mistake. That hurt me. I would never do that to somebody. I'm the victim here, right? And right away, we're creating this discrimination. And to a degree, we're kind of almost setting ourselves higher than them, maybe rightfully so, right? And this is something that Ellen will allude to next week in the precept about praising self and blaming others. Is kind of can veer into that territory, although that's a slightly different issue. But what is really going on here, perhaps, at least in my view, is that it's the small self trying to reify itself, the small self trying to create its space. Right? As I alluded to before, taking this version of reality that we think is absolutely true, and it can't be any other way, and this is the way it is, and we're putting it in this steel box, radioactive proof, nothing can get in, and we're trying to make that the only way things can be. Is that really the only way things can be? I was in Alms recently. I went to the art museum there, and they had a big David Hockney exhibit. And in great big letters on the wall was one of David Hockney's quotes: perspective must be reversed. Perspective must be reversed. And of course, he's meaning that in terms of how do you look at the world, and how do you create art out of that, and how do you represent what you're seeing? And of course, he did it quite well. If you know anything about David Hockney's art, he's had a very interesting eye for reality, representing reality in his very artistic way. So perspective can be reversed. How could I reverse my perspective when I am dwelling on others' past mistakes? Here's a radical notion. And I'm probably going to get some looks by saying this. People are doing the best they can. Now, before anyone starts throwing rotten tomatoes at me, let me qualify that statement, because I know what many of you are probably thinking is what I would think too. Like, no. My family member was definitely not doing the best he could when he was committing credit card fraud and stealing from me and ruining my life. That was not the best he could do. The best he could do was to not do those things. The best he could have done was to honor the trust I had put in him and kept his nose clean and done all the things he was supposed to be doing. He was definitely not doing the best he could do. And yet, if our practice teaches us anything, it teaches us about causes and conditions, the law of karma. Where we are at any point in time, where we are at right this moment, is only due to billions upon billions of countless causes and conditions that have brought us to this place, in this space, in this frame of mind. And right now, in this moment, it could be no other way, because all of these causes and conditions they manifested in this way, not some other way, not the way it should have been, not the way it could have been, but this right here, right now. And so when we think about others who have committed past mistakes, they've done these horrible things, They were doing the best they could because in their reality, all these causes and conditions, all these things that happened in their lives and all these ways that they engaged the world and the world engaged with them manifested in that moment where they committed this mistake. Even if it was absolutely horrible, you know better, right? You should have known better. You do know better. Yes, they probably did. I guarantee you that my family member, when he was in my friend's apartment and reaching for the credit card, in the back of his mind, something said, this is wrong. This is not what people do. So what was it that made him choose to do that anyway? It was the culmination of all the causes and conditions, all of that karma propelled forward into that moment where he justified his actions. And he went forward with the mistake. So there's a degree to which we kind of need to we need to parse a little bit what's ideal against what's possible. We hope that those are the same thing, but they aren't always, right? What might be ideal isn't always going to be possible for everyone. And I know in the fake case family member, there was a lot of trauma, you know, childhood trauma that he just did not deal with the right way. It was trauma that affected me too, but I was a little bit older. I had a different perspective, and I wasn't as affected as he was. He was very, very, very damaged by a pretty good collection of things, you know. And so I think about that and say, well, there's a degree to which he couldn't have been any other way. He couldn't have done anything different. And that doesn't let him off the hook, right? And people in our own lives who have committed horrible mistakes, you don't have to let them off the hook. You still hold them accountable, of course. In my particular case, I hold this person accountable by having absolutely no contact with him whatsoever. And he's reached out and he's tried to engage, and I'm just not going to have it. And maybe someday I will become bodhisattva that I want to be and then be able to engage him on some level with compassion and understanding, but I'm not there. It's been decades. I'm still not there yet. Can we look at people with openness and possibility? Because ultimately there is no separation from another. There is no separation between this person and self. There's ultimately no separation between good and bad intention. It all exists together. It's part of the flawless Dharma. Even the worst mistake maker on the planet is a bodhisattva. Domi alluded to this session, but there's a part in the Lotus Sutra where and all these people that are watching the Buddha do all these insane things like floating in midair and all these beams of light streaming from between all this cool stuff which raining down. And they're like, oh man, fully enlightened, but I missed out on the good stuff. You know? And they're kind of bummed. Like Shariputra is like, sheesh, man. You know? But he gets enlivened again when the Buddha starts handing out predictions of future Buddhahood.
Well, you will be this Buddha, and this will be your Dharma, and you will live in this Buddha land.
And Shariputra's like, me too? Oh, goody. And he gets in line, and he gets his prediction of Buddhahood like everybody else. Wouldn't my family member be in that line eventually too? Wouldn't the person who has committed the most egregious mistakes that you could possibly think of in your life, that maybe you've dwelt on a lot, wouldn't they ultimately be able to get in that line too? Aren't they a bodhisattva somewhere deep down under pain and the suffering that causes them to cause pain and suffering to others? Aren't they also a future Buddha? In the Metta Sutra that we were just chanting every night at session, it says, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none. omitting none. So with a boundless heart, we should cherish all living beings. It doesn't say only the people who have never made a horrible mistake. But the people who have made a horrible mistake, no compassion for them. It doesn't say that. How can we have unconditional compassion even for the people that we see as the worst of us? And maybe the people that we think are the worst of us are ourselves. If we've committed mistakes and we dwell on those mistakes and we have a lot of anger and self-loathing over the things that we've done. Can we swallow our pride and our own perceptions and move forward with grace and compassion? Can we hold in the Dharma of the middle way? Yes, we will hold people accountable. You know, make sure that they feel the consequences of their bad actions, but also look at them with love and compassion. Can you see the hurt, scared child underneath the mistakes that they have made? Can you have compassion for that small, scared, hurt person? Even if you are angry and absolutely, totally opposed to everything that they do have done. Can we create wisdom from ignorance, as the precept says? Create wisdom from the ignorance of others, from our own ignorance. Because as the precept says, in the Buddha Dharma, there's one path. There's not a path for us and a path for all those awful people. There's one path, one Dharma, one realization, and one practice. All right, so with the time we have left, I'd like to, a little less than I wanted, my apologies for that, I'm long-winded, as many of you know. I would like to pose some questions. Tyler has some breakout groups that he'd like to make, and we'll just end with that. We'll come back right before the end time, and we'll bow out, as they say. Yes?
Could I ask a question before you do that?
Please do.
First of all, it was a wonderful talk. Thank you so much for your thoughts and your story. Very sympathetic myself about the wayward family member. You said several times that this was do not dwell on the past mistakes of others. I have known many people who have looked at this and thought that it meant do not dwell on your own past mistakes. Mm-hmm. And you presented it that way.
Yeah.
So I just wondered what you thought of that, because you seemed pretty sure. I guess this was the way it was presenting itself to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought about kind of going down that angle, but because of the wording and it hints at it right there in the language of the precept too. Right.
See, I don't get the hint.
I mean, there's a degree to which I think the way that we view others is somewhat of a reflection of the way we can view ourselves, or vice versa. And so if I'm willing to dwell on the past mistakes of others, am I also willing to dwell on the past mistakes of myself? Or am I setting myself up as a good guy and everyone else is a bad guy? Or am I doing the opposite? And it's like, oh, everybody else is better than me, right? And I'm looking at myself as a bad guy because of the things I've done. So how do those intersect? Are you more or less willing to dwell on others' past mistakes by dwelling on the past mistakes of others? So this is a lot of questions. But I thought
stay in the one group.
Yeah.
We have less than 10 minutes now.
So. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I was hoping to have at least 15, 20, but. So, yeah, that's a good plan. You're right. Yeah, sorry, Tyler. Don't worry about the breakout rooms. That's a good point. I thought I'd offer some questions here for reflection. Are you dwelling on any past mistakes or faults of others? Why do you think you're dwelling on them? What would it be like to reverse your perspective, to use David Hockney's quote, and acknowledge the causes and conditions that brought them to that mistake? And how does that align? Because I think a lot of us feel that tension between, I want to show compassion. I want to understand that they're a hurting person that, you know, a hurt person that hurts people, but it's not right. Got to hold them accountable, right? So there's there can be this tension between those two seemingly opposite things. So if anyone would like to offer thoughts, thank you, Junior, for leading the way on that, or has any questions. Please take the seat there so that everybody can see you and hear you in the cloud.
I understand this precept, my sense of it, and it being about judgment, and I can see it about self-judgment or judging about others. But right now, and I from right the beginning, and how do you deal with the dwelling that many of us are doing on what's going on with Trump and with Musk? And I get that there's a place where it's like you want to be wrong, whatever, but it continues to have consequences for people, and they're big consequences if you look to the future. And I could say, okay, well, he had this kind of childhood, whatever. But anyway, that's sort of my question.
I don't know.
What was coming up over and over in my head.
And that was coming up for me too. I didn't want to explicitly call any of our current leadership in DC I didn't want to call them out by name, but that absolutely applies. For me, at least, just personally, it's not an exercise in doing anything other than keeping my own peace. And I see people, I have Facebook friends who are, you know, they're like actual friends. I know posting on Facebook is not a representation of how people go about their day. It's just like one aspect of it, but just the vitriol. And I'm like, how is this helping you to go on and on and on like this? Like, I understand we're all angry. We want something to be done. We need change. This is terrible. We want to help those who are being harmed, but the vitriol and the dwelling on current mistakes in this case, how is that helping you? Or is it making you making you angry? Are you constantly stressed and constantly frustrated? And I think we have to be angry and frustrated, but how far does it really have to go? Right. And so for me personally, I'm very angry with everything that's going on, but I also have moments where I can see past all the bluster and all of the show and all the pomp and all the just the ego. And I can see a scared little boy underneath it all. And if you look at just the story, I mean, the poor guy didn't have any chance. He had no other, it wasn't going to turn out any other way with his upbringing and where he came from and all that. He was going to be an ego man, no matter what, right? So like, I can see, like, I can look back and say, there's a scared little, I mean, nobody acts like this that's actually strong and confident, right? So he's full of nothing but fear and probably a high degree of self-loathing, right? Which he masks with this arrogance and this, you know, bombast. And so, Can I get to that scared little child? And can I have compassion for that scared little child? Does it have any impact on anything else? Not in a real super tangible way, but it helps me find some peace. It helps me with my practice. And it motivates me to go out and show compassion to others rather than spending time, wasting time ranting and raving about how awful it is. Like, I can turn that around and use it for good. Doesn't really change anything, but it's helping me.
Thank you.
So that makes me
thank you for this great talk. Sorry.
Go ahead, Ruthann.
I appreciate this talk. Thank you. And actually, before I took up any Buddhist practice, I would, my training, think, you know, they're doing the best they can. I don't know their background, but in the full sense of the word best in this moment, in this time. But I'm finding, it can't be an excuse that I'm older, but I live in a facility. So the people I see face to face, it's a lot harder. You know, I thank our three Oregon federal people in Washington, encouraging them. But when I first looked at the precepts, I noted Domio saying, pay attention to what jumps out at you first. And this one is big time because I've been dealing with that all my life. So I thought, oh, yeah, I'm wrestling with this every single day because I'm just, that's my lesson. You know, that's my Dharma talk. That's my gate. And thank goodness. I mean, it could be worse. I'm still on this first precept. And thank goodness I have that. I wouldn't be anywhere without working on it. So thanks for your talk and everyone tonight.
Thank you, Ruth Ann.
Yes. So, she had her hand up for me.
I don't know.
And I can't seem to stop sharing.
It's down now.
Okay. So there's another aspect of the precept, which of course you can't cover at all, right? So the other aspect, which is create wisdom from ignorance. So that's where I go with this. There's a time for arousing the compassion and whatever, but sometimes that's very difficult, right? And not even really called for necessarily. Mm-hmm. I love how you were both focusing on the dwelling part, because that's where we're starting to break the precept. Is the dwelling is not, we think we have to dwell in order to fix things, in order to move on. And we don't. Like, that's where we can trust. And like there, and also love who you're emphasizing about the present. So like we see, we can trust ourselves and our practice, that when we see what is going on, a compassionate and wise response will arise without us having to dwell and allow the wisdom to arise. Mm. We're not all stressed and too bitter for it to come up.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't know why. Oh, there's a stop share, but duh. It's right there in front of me. Okay, there we go. Good. Now I can see. All right. Well, I think we're time, right? 9 o'clock? What? I always forget the...
dedicate
the merit of this Dharma discussion to, or okay, well, dedicate the merit of this Dharma discussion to us so that they may be able to obtain the truth.
All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Vajna Paramita.
Thank you, James.
Thank you, James.
Thanks. Bye. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, James.
Goodbye. Bye-bye, everyone.